It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Eldar Shafir is with us. He's the co-author of Scarcity, Why Having Too Little Means So Much. The story so far being low on resources, things like time and money or social connections. It changes the way we think, oftentimes not for the better.
You can join the conversation with your questions and your experiences. How does being short on time or money affect you? And do you think you make better decisions or worse decisions when you're in a crunch? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on our Facebook page. It's Central Time at WPR.
Well, Eldar, getting back to you now, I mentioned usually not for the better. Are there times when scarcity, like in a deadline situation, can actually make us accomplish more?
Indeed. One thing that happens when you experience scarcity and you focus is that you do quite well on the thing on which you're focusing. So, you know, the poor who often neglect things and make errors do very well on the very specific thing they're handling right now. You know, they use their dollar better than those who live with plenty. They're very efficient. They know trade-offs. They know the prices of items in the supermarket they just bought, as opposed to the more wealthy who tend to neglect and not quite know all these things. So, in fact, when people focus on the thing they don't have enough of, whether it's time management or money, they do very well locally. But they leave less mind for other things, and often that comes back to haunt them when errors happen on the periphery.
Are there ways we can use this knowledge in our personal lives and say, I know I'm focusing on scarcity, I need to break out of that to do this other thing that's outside of that scarcity tunnel?
Indeed, or more even just even thinking about bandwidth more generally. So, you know, when I was waiting to talk to you and I had a few minutes free, I've learned not to check my email. Because in that email, there's going to be one message that distresses me or worries me, reminds me of a deadline I've missed. And I'm going to think about that, and part of my mind while talking to you is going to be spent on an email, and it's a mistake. So thinking about your bandwidth management in some sense, not distracting yourself with things that may as well wait when you're doing something important, arranging your day so that the things that require more mind happen early and things that require less mind happen in the moments when you plan to be distracted, leaving some slack throughout the day to catch up and manage things you hadn't anticipated. Those are all ways that, you know, when you develop intuition, make your management of the day a lot more easy if time is a scarce resource.
Can you talk more about the idea of slack? That's something you explore in your book, and you just mentioned it in terms of time there.
Yeah, so the general notion of slack, you know, we use this metaphor of a suitcase. You know, some people travel with a very small, tightly packed suitcase. The things you need barely fit, and that creates a lot of difficulties. Anytime you want to add anything, you know, you like a pair, you buy a pair of shoes you like, you have to decide what to take out of the suitcase to make room for this new pair of shoes. When you have a larger suitcase with slack in it, life is a lot easier because you can just put things in that you hadn't planned because there's slack in your suitcase. You can move things around. You don't have to pack as carefully. And that has a lot of implications for everyday life. When you have some slack, it allows you to manage the unexpected. It allows you to pay less attention to how you pack your stuff throughout the day. When you're very, very busy and you commit to a lot of stuff, you have no slack. One meeting that goes late, one unanticipated traffic jam, and your entire schedule for the day has derailed, requiring more attention, more bandwidth, and leading you to forget, you know, picking up the kids from school, the car that's in the parking meter, or whatever else happens. They just can't, you know, have enough bandwidth at that moment.
And how can we prioritize a long-term versus a short-term solution? I'll give a personal example. You know, work, like many people, there's a time crunch.
Mm-hmm.
I know if I cleaned my desk every day, I'd have a benefit from that, and I'd actually have a little more time because I'm not digging through things on the desk. But it never seems like there's that time for it now. How can someone like me rechannel, take the effort up front to do that long-term payoff and put off that short-term stuff? Or is that possible?
That's a big challenge. I mean, you know, I think being aware of it and being smart about it and realizing the limitations that we encounter every day, you know, the way our mental machinery works, it's not always completely intuitive, is a big step. And then in the book, we propose some, you know, general strategies. So, for example, things that you can do once that will take care of a recurring problem. You know, you want to go to the exercise, you want to go to the gym twice a week, and it's not happening. One phone call to a trainer who waits for you from now on, Tuesday and Thursday, is a big step. You might still miss a few, but the stress to be there when somebody's sitting there waiting is, you know, very different from just planning to go there on your own. Committing to automatic deductions, committing to, you know, automatic small transfers from checking to long-term savings, anything you can do once to take care of a commitment for the long term is a big facilitator and, you know, opens bandwidth for other things. the cleaning the office is a classic example of where, you know, when you have too much imposing on you at the moment, things that are less critical tend to wait. You know, you're constantly fighting fires, and things that are not so burning, as it were, just wait for another time. And so we end up, you know, not getting our medical exams on time, not writing our wills when we should, you know, things like that. They always seem to have another day they can wait for, as opposed to the small stuff that needs to be done now, even if sometimes it's less important in the long run.
Well, again, earlier in the discussion, we talked about how public policy might deal with this in terms of poverty and having default decisions, scheduled payments instead of random ones. Mm-hmm. Are there other public policy take-homes from what you're talking about that we could have these default decisions and spare us some bandwidth?
Yeah, so, you know, the general idea is, again, it depends, of course, on who's the population, who you're dealing with, what the problem is. But the awareness of bandwidth is really interesting. So think about, you know, offering some benefits program for, you know, low-income workers. If you offer somebody, for example, food stamps, it would never occur to you to charge them $200 to join the program. I mean, that's exactly what they don't have. You're not going to charge them money for it. Now, what about bandwidth? You know, these people come to you money poor, but also bandwidth poor. What can we do to charge less bandwidth? When we present them with 15, you know, menacing pages of complicated language, lots of, you know, signing needing and under penalty of perjury if you represented anything, that's a massive bandwidth tax. If there were ways to facilitate all that, they could make a big difference. And in fact, some recent studies have shown if you take FAFSA, for example, it's a benefit for going to college. You take people who know they're eligible, and you compare their tendency to apply and matriculate to those who have the same form, but now somebody helps them fill out the form. You know, just literally sit with them and fill it out. That ends up increasing matriculation in college by 30 to 40%. That's a very cheap way to increase college attendance, just filling out somebody's form. And it's not intuitive unless you realize that for somebody who's bandwidth limited, filling out that 12 or 15 page form is a massive imposition. You know, they don't say, I won't do it, but they say, you know, some other time, you know, the same day you clean the office, that's when they'll apply to college. And years go by.
You also, in your book, talk some about the business world and some of the applications here. What could a business owner or manager take from your book and maybe get better performance out of employees?
Well, everything from controlling the management of time to the management of bandwidth, and in some cases, even the management of money or social connections. So you basically, what you want to do if you're managing a company or a business is decide what are the sources of scarcity that impose on your workers, on your people's bandwidth the most, and how you could facilitate it. It might be childcare. Some people spend an inordinate amount of time worrying, who's going to take care of my kid tomorrow when I have to work an evening shift. That concern, that juggling of who's going to take care of the child every day, is a massive bandwidth imposition. You institute an easier, more friendly childcare arrangement, and all of a sudden you've liberated a lot of bandwidth for people to attend to things that might matter, you know, to you and to the business a lot more. Reminders, you know, secretaries who come in and announce the meeting is over, arranging meetings at the right times when people are not too preoccupied by things that happened 10 minutes earlier, imposing some slack, time that's built into your schedule where you just sit down and catch up on things that you have planned badly and have fallen on the wayside. All these kind of increase productivity. There's some evidence that actually make workers work fewer hours and do better.
Well, Eldar, thank you so much for spending your time and your bandwidth with us today.
It was a pleasure.
That was Eldar Shafir, professor of psychology and public affairs at Princeton University. He's co-author of Scarcity, Why Having Too Little Means So Much.
Coming up, we kick off a WPR series on the 50th anniversary of a court case that established a right to legal counsel for low-income people accused of crimes.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. Half a century ago, a convicted Florida man wrote a handwritten letter to the United States Supreme Court. He argued that he was denied justice because he couldn't afford a lawyer and should have been given one at his trial. That letter led to the right to counsel for low-income people accused of crimes. Mike Simonson begins our series on the 50th anniversary of Gideon versus Wainwright.
Fresh out of law school and on his first day in private practice, Superior Attorney Toby Markovich was appointed to take a case of a man who couldn't afford a lawyer. Markovich demanded a preliminary hearing. The judge didn't like that and threatened to cite him for contempt of court. That was 1954, 9 years before the Gideon decision.
We got paid nothing to do this, but my client, shortly before deer season opened, brought me a big bag of venison. But anyhow, that was my first experience with being appointed counsel, and it was almost my last.
the judge didn't hold Markovich in contempt. But while judges in Wisconsin generally did appoint a lawyer for people who couldn't afford one, Douglas County Public Defender J. Patrick O'Neill says it was often long after a person had been charged and interrogated and not long before the trial began.
If he felt the person deserved representation, he'd say, "Bailiff, go find a lawyer." Bailiff would go out, wander the halls of the courthouse, maybe go down to the local coffee shop, whatever. When he found the guy that he recognized was a lawyer, "The judge wants you right now," drag him into court. The judge would say, "You know, Mr. Lawyer, here's your new client. There you go."
O'Neill says more than half of the people accused of crimes in Douglas County qualify for a court-appointed attorney. Before Gideon, it was hit or miss if a judge would appoint representation in most states. Walter Dickey has taught at the UW School of Law since 1976. He says defense attorneys weren't commonplace.
It's not just there was no right. There was no culture in which criminal defendants were uniformly having an expectation of representation.
The Constitution Project's Criminal Justice Policy Counsel Liz Fossey says the lack of legal expertise aside, a courtroom is a pretty intimidating place for a person without an attorney.
It meant that they were facing the great resources of the state against them.
That means police, investigators, prosecuting attorneys, and a judge. Before Gideon, Fossey says many people were found guilty of crimes they didn't commit.
Unfortunately, we don't really know how much injustice was done. According to the National Registry of Exonerations, we now are at over 1,200 individuals who have been exonerated for crimes that they did not commit. Unfortunately, that's probably just the tip of the iceberg.
On June 3, 1961, Clarence Gideon was convicted of stealing wine and change from a vending machine in a Florida pool hall. He asked for but was denied an attorney. Sentenced to 5 years in prison, the man with an eighth-grade education wrote a letter to the U.S. Supreme Court asking for a new trial. In an archival interview, Gideon said he didn't need a law degree to write that letter.
"I thought that was a constitutional right, and I didn't know no different. Another man with money can hire a lawyer to represent him. He'd get a better chance in a trial than I would get without an attorney. To me, that was just common sense. There was no argument to it."
On March 13, 1963, the court ruled unanimously that Clarence Gideon's constitutional rights were violated and that everyone has the right to counsel. Gideon was found innocent in a second trial. Still practicing law in Superior, Toby Markovich says Gideon changed everything.
"Yeah, I mean, we were getting probably too many assigned cases as private attorneys before the public defenders system came in effect, but after Gideon, it was overwhelming."
State legislatures funded public defender programs, and people who couldn't afford an attorney got one.
"It was a good thing. Even when I was a prosecutor, I really felt that it was important for defendants to have their rights preserved. There was some bad stuff going on occasions, people actually being deprived of rights, given bad information, sometimes maybe deliberately."
Mike Simonson, Wisconsin Public Radio in Superior.
And thanks to Mike for that report.
Fifty Shades of Grey, Beloved, and The Kite Runner were all books that in 2012 some people thought shouldn't be in schools or school libraries. Last year, over 400 titles were challenged.
Every year, the national book community draws attention to these books and calls to the freedom to read with Banned Books Week. And we'd love to know, what do you do, if anything, to observe Banned Books Week? Do you think some books should be left out of school libraries? Or should kids have access to all these titles? And have you ever challenged a book in your own library? And if you're a fan of some of these banned books, which ones? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can let us know on the Central Time Facebook page.
In just a few moments, we'll talk to someone from the American Library Association. First, we've got the author of a book that's been challenged in libraries, Peter Parnell, co-author of And Tango Makes Three. It's on the list of the top 10 challenged titles in 2012. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
So as an author of a kid's book, what's it like to hear that your book has been challenged in a library?
Well, let's see. You know, we wrote the book with certain goals in mind, certain ideas about reaching people. It's the book And Tango Makes Three, once right before it was published, was received wonderful pre-publication reviews and wonderful comments from people. It took probably 6 months to then the better part of about a year before we were then getting comments that were not so favorable from parents. And, of course, it's always troubling to hear that. But, you know, the issue of censorship itself is especially troubling, and it's one of the reasons that the ALA is so valuable. It's one of the reasons that it's important to know when attempts at removing books or placing them in other parts of libraries is happening. And, you know, we've been very grateful to the local newspapers that follow what the activities of libraries, both public and school libraries, are. And we've been most grateful by the positive feelings that we've gotten, especially from librarians all around the country, as well as from many families.
Well, can you briefly sum up the plot of your book and the grounds that people were challenging it, asking it to be moved or taken off the shelf at their library?
Sure. And Pandemic 3 is a picture book, a children's picture book, that is tells a true story. It's the book was published in 2005 originally. We first heard about it from a New York Times article that dealt with the story of two male penguins in the Central Park Zoo who pair bonded, and during the mating season time, they pair bonded and they were always together and did everything together. They sang together and they swam together. They spent all of their time together, and during the mating season, the head of the Arctic Zone of the Central Park Zoo, Rob Granzey, noticed that the two male penguins attempted to hatch a rock. This is at the time when penguin couples build nests, and then after they build nests, they sit on their eggs to hatch their eggs. And Roy and Silo, these two male penguins, built a nest together, and they brought a rock that looked like an egg, tried to hatch it. Rob Granzey and the rest of the zoo knew of a penguin family who was continually unable to hatch more than one egg, and if there was another fertilized egg, that couple would kick the egg out of the nest, but they were losing that egg. And Rob and the zoo decided to give that fertilized egg to Roy and Silo. And they took care of the egg and did all of the things that you do, that penguin couples do, feeding, making sure that each other is fed, keeping the egg warm, sitting on the egg, turning the egg, doing all the things in the months that it takes for the egg to hatch, which it did. And the zoo named that baby Tango. Roy and Silo were together for, I believe, over 7 years. Before they changed mates. And this story was a story that was written about, as I say, in the Times, and it interested us largely as a way to talk about different kinds of families and the fact that that there can be two dad families, there can be two mom families. And so we wrote it bearing as close to the truth in terms of what we knew and read about and interviewing Rob Granzey and others at the zoo as well.
And then people have challenged it just in a minute or so. What were the grounds and what was the response from libraries?
Well, the grounds had to do with whether children should be hearing the story. That's not for as an argument. We're not saying that the book, we wrote the book to help parents teach children or for families to talk about same-sex parent families. And the book is no more, an argument in favor of gay relationships than it is a call for children to, swallow their fish whole or sleep on rocks. I mean, it's a true story. And the fact is that as a picture book, as a story about families, that's how children relate to it. We understand and we know that there's a great deal of anxiety, especially among conservative parents, when it comes to talking to children about gay families. But the notion that telling a child about gay people will increase his or her chances of becoming gay is scientifically untenable. It endures. It's something that people do have anxiety about, but it hasn't been proven. In fact, quite the opposite has been shown. However, be that aside, if a library buys a book and the book is in that library, it is against the First Amendment of the Constitution to attempt to remove it.
Peter, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That's Peter Parnell, co-author of And Tango Makes Three. It's on the banned books list, and we're going to talk more about that with Deborah Caldwell Stone of the American Library Association after the news.
And we want to know what you think about banned books. Have you challenged a book before? Do you count banned books among your favorite reads of all time? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You're listening to Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We'll pick up our conversation now about Banned Books Week. We've got a representative from the American Library Association with us talking about what Banned Books Week is and what kind of books get challenged or removed from libraries.
And we'd love to know how you observe Banned Books Week. Do you count among your favorite books maybe something that shows up on a banned books list? Have you ever challenged a book and thought that it should be taken out of a school library? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can always post, too. That's on our Central Time Facebook page.
We have Deborah Caldwell Stone with us now, Deputy Director for the American Library Association's Office for Intellectual Freedom. Deborah, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on this afternoon.
Well, you were listening along with Peter Parnell there talking about his book that's on the banned books list. What does it take to get a book on that list each year?
Generally, your book is one of the books that's most challenged in the country for that year. We measure challenges from January to December so that this year's top 10 list reflects challenges that were reported to our office between January 2012 and December 2012.
And what is Banned Books Week? Why do we need to draw attention to this?
Well, Banned Books Week is our annual celebration of our freedom to read, and also an observance of the fact that, in fact, that books are still censored in our country. Despite the fact that we are a country that has a First Amendment, a promise of free speech, free expression, the freedom to receive those ideas as well. And most often these challenges occur at the local level with school boards and library boards. There are many requests to remove books, and every so often a book is actually removed from the shelf.
Isn't there a valid reason sometimes to remove a book? You don't want something too grown up in the kids section. Maybe there's something that a community feels isn't appropriate anywhere in the library where kids could see it. Is there a plus side, an argument in favor of challenging books?
Well, in fact, most books that are challenged are intended for the audience they're meant for. For example, And Tango Makes Three is meant for elementary students, and it was housed in children's libraries. And it's the same thing for Captain Underpants, which was our number one most challenged book this year. So often the books have been acquired by the library or acquired by the school board because they are developmentally appropriate, that they are part of the, you know, they do serve the curriculum, but that somebody objects to some of the ideas that are expressed in the book or the language used in the book, and asks that the book be removed. So it's very, very infrequent that a book would be removed because there's an opportunity to remove a book because it's, you know, so beyond the pale. Some might argue that 50 Shades of Grey, which was number four on our list, meets that criteria. That book was primarily in adult collections, intended for adult audiences, was the kind of book that there are books like it in libraries across the country. that deal with, you know, explicitly deal with romance and relations between people. And so to argue that that was beyond the pale as well, when it's appropriately shelved in the adult collection and borrowed by adults, is also demonstrates that there's very few instances where books that are are in libraries should be removed.
And can you give us a sense of some of the other books that often find their way onto the list? What are some repeat customers, if you will?
Well, absolutely, True Diary of a Part-Time Indian. This is its second year on the list. Beloved by Toni Morrison has frequently appeared on our list and is also part of our top 10 this year. Looking for Alaska by John Green. Books that are intended for YA audiences are often challenged. And our general observation is that books that are most frequently challenged, most challenges, involve an effort to protect young people from books, which may be a laudable motivation, but often involved, as I said before, trying to protect young people from ideas that of which a person disapproves, not because the book is inappropriate or at the wrong age level. And so we challenge that kind of censorship. If there's any foundation for the First Amendment at all, is that the government, as particularly public libraries, public schools, shouldn't be barring access to ideas because someone disapproves of them. And so we have this celebration, this observation every year to bring that up and to celebrate our freedom to read.
Let's go to the phones now. We have Shannon on the line in Kenosha. Hi, Shannon.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to tell us about?
So I have two daughters who just started college. They're in their freshman year this year. And when they were younger, my husband and I would use the Banned Books Week to choose a book that had been either that was on the list or that had been challenged in the past. And we would read the book as a family, and we would discuss why we thought the book had been challenged and what were the ideas in it that people found so controversial.
Interesting. Thanks a lot, Shannon. What do you think about that, Deborah?
It's actually a great way of using Banned Books Week for learning about what idea, about challenges and why certain ideas are disapproved of because they're unorthodox, and reaffirming why the reading is important and making up your own mind about literature for yourself. We encourage libraries across the country, schoolrooms across the country. That's precisely what teachers and librarians are doing this week with Banned Books Week, is discussing these books, learning from these books, and learning why such challenges come about, and what individuals can do to fight censorship and to think for themselves.
Thanks a lot for the call, Shannon. We'll go now to David in Dubuque, Iowa. Hi there, David.
Hi. I'm a retired librarian, and when I worked in a public library in Marin County, California, I created a Banned Books Week exhibit. May have not been original, but I thought it was it was effective. I bound wrapped about 25 books in plain brown paper, and then on each one, they were banned books, and on each one I put a little legend that said why the book was banned, and, you know, sort of was a guessing game for users of the library to say, oh, they're reading about why this was banned. What book could that be? And then on the back would be the answer.
Got it, David.
Yes.
David, thanks. I want to get a response from Deborah. Is that something that you see a lot of librarians do around the country?
Libraries frequently do displays of banned books to highlight the week and to give readers the opportunity to discover these works of literature and to consider why they were banned. Often people call our office and are just astounded to find out that a favorite novel of theirs made the top 10 list, and they just can't even conceive why somebody would want to remove it from the hands of students or from the readers of a community. And it's a great educational tool to highlight the problems of censorship in our country today.
Do you see banned books as an issue that's on the decline? Are we challenging fewer and fewer books, or is this something that we're going to be marking for years to come?
I think that's something we'll mark for years to come because, as I noted before, there are parents, there are community members who are concerned for young people, and they have their opinions, their beliefs about what young people should be reading about, what ideas they should be exposed to, and they will voice their concerns about that. And actually, that's their right. They should. You know, every citizen should be able to petition the public library board or the school board, and have their concerns considered. However, if the request is to remove the book from the hands of the students or from all the readers in a community simply because that individual disapproves of the values or the language used in a book, that's the kind of censorship that we just have never really supported as a value in our country. It's what the First Amendment was designed to fight, was official suppression of ideas. And, you know, what we, for our country, is really all about the democratic value of allowing everyone to make up their own mind after considering ideas for themselves. The concern is never going to go away, particularly since most challenges are about what young people read. On the other hand, we would hope that over time that there's some shared value about protecting everyone's right to choose for themselves what kinds of books they read and what kinds of ideas they encounter.
Deborah, thank you so much for joining us today.
No problem. Thank you.
That's Deborah Caldwell-Stone, Deputy Director for the American Library Association's Office for Intellectual Freedom.
Coming up, emotional intelligence has become a prized trade in education. We'll find out how schools are trying to teach it to kids to boost academic performance.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.
Coming up, a history of a meal and a concept. It's breakfast time coming up after 5.
First, schools are trying to help kids handle their emotions in the hopes of boosting academic performance. The goal is to increase emotional intelligence, which in turn can help kids achieve in school and beyond.
Mark Brackett joins us. He's at the vanguard of what's known as social-emotional learning. He's senior research scientist in psychology and director of the Yale Center for Emotional Intelligence. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Well, what benefits are we seeing for teaching emotional skills alongside academics in school?
So what we found in our research is that teaching emotional intelligence and social and emotional learning influences two main things. One is the skills that children have and that the adults have, but also we're finding shifts in just the overall climate of schools, making them more positive places for kids to learn and teachers to teach.
When we talk about emotional skills and emotional intelligence, what are we talking about in terms of what a kid might do and learn and get more conversant in?
So we have a model that we call RULER, and RULER is an acronym for 5 critical skills of emotional intelligence. The first is recognizing emotions, and that has to do with being able to read emotions in the face and body and voice and posture. The U is understanding the causes and the consequences of emotions, where they come from, what makes me feel angry versus sad. The L is labeling, putting a sophisticated vocabulary to our emotional states. The E is expressing emotions, knowing the how and the when and in what context to express emotions. And then the final R is the regulation of emotion, the strategies that we use to manage.
So now what you've just described, this isn't the usual domain of public schools. Can you give us an example of how a lesson in handling emotions might play out in a classroom?
Sure. So what will often happen in schools that have adopted a RULER is that their morning meeting will include a check-in with students to find out, are they coming in what we call the yellow, the green, or the blue, or the red. Yellow is high energy and pleasant, and red is unpleasant but high in energy, and blue is low energy but sort of unpleasant, and green is sort of that calm place. And so the teacher will get to see, you know, wow, I have a student who came in the red, and maybe they're feeling anxious about upcoming tests, or in the blue because a grandparent is in the hospital. And that allows the teacher to gauge, you know, how that student will learn that day and what strategies that student might need in order to get the most out of his or her learning experience.
And would that also be how they would handle conflicts that arose during the day with their peers in the classroom?
So there are other tools for that. By way of example, we have a tool we call the meta moment. which is a process to teach children how to activate their best possible self. And so children go through activities where they start thinking about their best self and what are the adjectives that describe me at my personal best. And what teachers do is help kids remind themselves about these attributes so that they behave more proactively. Hmm. And also we have a tool called the Blueprint, which is when a conflict arises, what we ask students to do is sit down either by themselves or with the other person to go through a process of identifying their own feelings, identifying the feelings of the other person, and basically problem solving around those ruler skills that I mentioned.
Now, this used to be something that kids learn kind of by osmosis in their peer group, at home, in the house. Maybe their parents tried to teach them. Why is now the school seen as the right place for this to happen?
Well, when you think about the daily life of a student in school, it's an emotional roller coaster. They have friends, they don't have friends. They ate breakfast, they didn't eat breakfast. They got positive feedback, they got negative feedback. Somebody wants to play with them, somebody doesn't want to play with them. The day in the life of a student is emotional, and the wide range of emotions they experience need to be identified and managed effectively so they can be the best possible student.
Well, there's been a lot of failed movements in education. In the 80s, I gather, you know, kids used to say positive mantras like, I am beautiful, I am smart, and that didn't end up working very well, apparently. Do you think there's enough data out there right now to back up the push that we're seeing for emotional skills and emotional intelligence education right now?
So we've done, you know, well over 100 studies in our laboratory. To show that children who have more developed emotional skills live better lives. They have greater emotional well-being, less stress and anxiety. They have better quality relationships. They perform better academically. So the skills are really showing up as being quite important. And our center, as well as other organizations, have done lots of studies looking at the impact of emotional intelligence in the classroom. And the results are positive, that schools that adopt these types of approaches have students with improved performance, both academically, but also less bullying, better quality relationships.
Now, there are also all kinds of approaches to teaching this. You mentioned you have yours, which is called Ruler. There are others, and some of the lessons, they come prepackaged, and the kids just sort of go through them and through these, you know, sort of like they might learn a prepackaged math assignment. Do they all work equally well, or is that something we're still getting a handle on which ones are the most effective?
Yes, yeah, so the research in this area is still growing, and you know, we don't like to say that our approach is better than anyone else's approach. You know, different schools have different ways of incorporating this into their systems. So some approaches work better for some schools, others work better for, you know, other schools. And essentially, it's really about match, you know, between the approach or the program and the school.
Now, I can imagine that some teachers would greet this with open arms and be enthusiastic, and other teachers would say, I barely have time, you know, to get through what I have to get through with, you know, federal standards and state standards, core curriculum now. I don't have time to add this stuff, which may not yet, we don't know for sure, help with the test scores. What would you say to teachers, you know, who might be reluctant to make room in their curriculum and in their learning day for something like this?
You know, I would ask teachers to think about their own education. And I would ask them to think about the anxiety that they may have had in school or the fears if they were someone who was bullied or the boredom that they may have had, and ask them whether or not they believe that that influenced the way they learned and their enjoyment of school. And what you find is that it's pretty much 100% say, of course, you know, when I was bored, I was sort of not paying attention, or when I was feeling anxious, I couldn't concentrate. And that sort of what it does is it helps teachers see the relevance and importance of this work, both from their own perspective and from their students' perspective. And then importantly, what I would do is really teach teachers about the value of emotions in education, that it's not just about teaching kids to be less angry or stressed, but about engagement and how emotions drive students' interest and curiosity in learning.
would teachers themselves need to go through this training? I mean, not you can find plenty of grown-ups who might not be emotionally aware, able to put their finger on what they're feeling. So do they need to be able to do that first before they can help kids?
That is the way we do things. So in our approach, we believe it's critical for adults to be trained before they teach these skills to their students so that they themselves understand the importance of emotion regulation, that they understand there are a wide variety of strategies. For example, some people like to talk with others. Some people like to sit alone quietly and read books. And that we don't force people to choose one specific strategy, but identify the strategy that works best for them in different situations. And when the adults see that, it just makes it so much easier for them to teach that to their students.
Now, we talked about bullying, and you said that it could help bullying. And I know I read in the New York Times article that you yourself were bullied, sounds like pretty severely, when you were a kid. Is that what sort of brought all this around for you?
Well, multiple things made me interested in this work. The first was that I was not a happy student, particularly in middle school. And I was one of those kids who was very anxious because I was bullied. And, you know, ironically, a few months ago, my father showed me my report cards from middle school, and I was not a very good student. And it just made me realize again, you know, that when your brain is filled with worry and fear of getting from one class to the other or getting home safely, it just can't be present in the learning environment. So that to me is critically important in terms of, you know, motivating me to get into this line of work, but also it's the broader context and understanding the power of emotions to help people achieve their goals and help people face their fears and overcome the obstacles they have and to really make classrooms places where students are thinking and critically involved in things like ancient history, where they identify with the characters. So it really is there's a much broader reason for my interest in the work.
So I've only got about 30 seconds left here, but you know, for a long time, schools have emphasized the academics and left the emotional child, you know, to the parents or whatever else might shape that side of them. Is this an effort to teach the whole child?
It is. So some of us call it the other side of the report card. Some of us call it the missing piece. But my hope is that schools will soon understand that emotions are the driver of attention and learning, decision-making, relationship quality, and, of course, academic achievement. And that when that is fully understood, perhaps our nation's education system will embrace emotional intelligence more seriously.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking to Mark Brackett, director of the Yale Center for Emotional Intelligence.
Coming up, a look at breakfast, why we eat cereal or eggs and other cultures might be happier with a spicy beef soup. You can head over to our Facebook page, Central Time on WPR. Tell us, what do you eat for breakfast each and every day? Stick around, there's more to come on Central Time on the Ideas Network.